people spoiling you. How fascinating to share the active lovemaking with another. A virtuoso trio when you get practiced at it. There may be times when someone has little to do and could feel left out. When that happens to you, think about how an extra pair of hands might be useful in whatever the other two are doing and gently join in. One time in such a moment, Dasi was temporarily left out while the couple who were her lovers were having intercourse with each other. She felt a little shy, thought about joining in, and then noticed that these two people who had been together for quite a few years were amazingly graceful in their deep connection with each other. So Dasi settled in to watch for a while and was happy and content just to witness such beauty. When they were through, they welcomed Dasi into their embrace, and further delights occurred that were well worth waiting for. Do remember that there is privilege in being an outside partner. You can, if you choose, get to be all about fun and leave the heavy stuff to the partners who will go home with one another afterward. Or maybe you'd rather be there to help out when the kids all come down with chickenpox. Whatever fits for you, remember that there is privilege in being the play partner. As one friend of ours puts it, I get to be dessert. Groups. When your lover has a whole bunch of partners, making agreements can look like major treaty negotiations and might require some diplomacy. Some groupings have boundaries around who a member may connect with. Perhaps the other members want to meet and approve. That's an easy one. Some will want outside partners to clearly understand the group's limits and boundaries, especially about safer sex, which is great. And we are very happy to see that some poly groups are very thoughtful about how they make connection to a new person and are willing to take the time to get things right. Some groups might want you to join in one way or another, having sex with the group, moving in with the group, becoming part of a group marriage, that may or may not fit for you. You, of course, get to look at what's being asked and decide if that is what you want and to define your own desires and limits. Many initial disagreements can eventually be negotiated if all the parties involved are open-minded and operating in good faith. And if they aren't, you might be better off learning that right at the start. One friend of ours connected with a person who had two primary partners and wanted our friend as a secondary. But when our friend asked what would happen if he were to acquire a primary partner himself, they said, "Oh no, that wouldn't be acceptable." So our friend opted out. Most group marriages and circles that we have encountered are much more lightly held and flow easily with new partners who may someday join the group at large, over time and one step at a time. Dasi belonged to one such family when her daughter was a baby. There were no formal membership requirements, and everyone fit together and grew together as they went along, with partnerships forming and separating and reforming on their own timetables, and everyone responsible for the whole gang of children. This adaptive arrangement worked very well for quite a few years. Not forever, but for a good, happy, memorable, long time. Single soliloquy, Dasi writes. Someone at a workshop once asked me, "Don't you get lonely living alone?" I was startled, and it took me a second to understand that he wasn't trying to make me feel bad. What an ache he innocently opened in me. I had to say, "Yes, of course I get lonely. And yet, I have lived about half my adult life single. Some things are hard to do by yourself. I recently bought my first house. How I yearned for a partner in that scary endeavor. But I managed somehow. I dealt with my fears, and with realtors and mortgage brokers and roofers and inspectors, and now I have a sweet little home in the woods, like me, mine to share with others when and how I choose. Nothing lasts forever." Someone asked me if I feared being alone in my old age. I am now in my 60s, and you bet I'm afraid of that. I saw my mother live to be 93 in the house she shared with my father during their 37-year marriage. Only he died of cancer when they were 65. nothing lasts forever. I still crave the thrill of falling in love, the dream of a romance so magical it could never fade, and I know better. When I have fallen in love in the past, the long-term outcome has been a crapshoot, sometimes great, sometimes disastrous. After 8 such relationships, I must admit I have no idea how to predict the future of any passion, whether we will grow into a solid and sustaining kind of love, or whether we will grow to hate each other. Now, I am a person who prefers burning passion to sweet reason, and I don't consider myself very good at compromise. But my compromise for my own survival is to learn to live single and to make a very good life of it, a lifelong commitment to myself. Long ago, I thought of singlehood as being between old men, some condition of waiting for the next one and only to show up. It was like being on hold, waiting for one and only number 4 to pick up the phone, not like living a real life. In 1969, when I was first a slut on purpose and a baby feminist, I decided to live single for 5 years so I could discover who I might be when I'm not trying to be somebody's wife. But how was I going to make this work? I didn't want to live and raise my child in a cold world with no affection or intimacy, so I devised a scheme for sharing love with lovers I had no intention of living with. Back then, there was very little precedent for sharing sex with someone you were not auditioning for a long-term partnership. So I invented ways that I could take the risky steps of sharing affection openly with people I had not secured, if I can call it that. I told them what I liked about them. I good-mouthed. I sought out opportunities to be demonstrative. I used the L word and insisted on calling the feelings I had for each of my lovers by their true name, love. And when I had the courage to be loving, the result was that I got a lot of love back. It is true that I first learned to love this way as a survival technique for living single, but it has become something far more valuable. An open affection for who and what I love around me has become my foundation and my way of life, whether or not I am living with a partner. I am confident that this approach can work for everyone, whatever their lifestyle, and even when they are not sharing sex. Wouldn't it make a fine world if we all made it a point to honor and cherish and openly value every person we make connection with? I raised my child with this sense of community. Being a mother taught me to respect limits and boundaries, and certainly to refuse to welcome in my home or in my heart anyone or anything that threatened the well-being of my child or me. By extension, I learned to better protect my own vulnerabilities, which made me even more capable of expressing my love for others. I live in the country, and I feel this same kind of heart-opening love when I walk on a beach, or look at the world from the top of a small mountain, or discover, around some bend in a trail, a 2,000-year-old tree standing in majesty. I feel no desperation, nor any desire to cling. I just feel happy. Do I sometimes feel lonely? Sure. Do I love my life? Immensely. Sometimes I think I am the luckiest person in the world. Chapter 20. The Ebb and Flow of Relationships. We observe, with much delight, the number of our old lovers we count among our present friends, and we marvel at how sexual relationships can develop into family memberships. There is a reality limit here. You have only 24 hours a day to devote to your love life, and presumably you need some of those hours for work and sleep and so on, so you have a finite amount of time to devote to each of your lovers. You can fit only a certain number of people in your life and expect to do any of them justice. We find that most people do okay letting their partners come and go as it feels right for each of them. extended family sexual relationships are more likely to grow apart than to break up. One of the very wonderful things about building sexual friendships is that while past relationships and smaller affairs may come and go over the years, each pairing has its own characteristic and unique intimacy. You create this intimacy the way you learn to ride a bike, by trial and error, slipping and falling, and ultimately zooming along together. Just like riding a bike, you'll never forget this particular intimacy or your own role in it. Even after the most bitter of separations, when conflict is cleared and time has healed the wounds, you may find that you can slip that connection right back on, like a comfortable old glove. On the other hand, sometimes conflict in an intimate relationship goes on so long, or seems so impossible to resolve, that it threatens the very foundation of that relationship. We hope you bring the same high level of ethics and concern to a conflicted relationship that you brought to a happy one. It is always tempting to respond to a major relationship conflict by assigning blame. In childhood, we learn that pain in the form of punishment from our all-powerful parents is the consequence of doing something wrong. So when we hurt, we try to make sense of it by finding somebody doing something wrong, preferably somebody else. We have discussed the problems that come from blaming and projection before. What is important to remember is that most relationships break up because the partners are unhappy with each other. And no one is to blame. Not you, not your partner, and not your partner's lover. Even if someone acted badly or was dishonest, your primary relationship probably isn't falling apart for that reason. Relationships tend to end due to their own internal stresses. Even your authors have trouble remembering this when we are in the middle of a bitter breakup. When you find yourself wanting to blame, it may help to remember a truism of relationship counseling. The client is the relationship itself, not either of the people in it. During a breakup, it is supremely useless to try to ascertain who is right and who is wrong. The question is, what needs to happen next? If you start looking at conflicts as problems to be solved instead of trying to decide whose fault they are, you have taken an important first step in solving them. Some people habitually bear the burden of being responsible for everybody's emotional well-being and feel that they're somehow at fault because they're unable to magically make everyone's pain and trouble disappear. Instead of refusing to own their stuff, one partner takes too much responsibility for the problem at hand. Such people need to learn to own their own bit and let everybody else own theirs. It's also common for one partner to take too little responsibility. People who have a lot of their self-esteem connected to their ability to maintain a relationship may feel the need to make their partner into the villain in order to justify their own desire to leave. This strategy is unfair to both of you. It gives the villain all the power in the relationship and disempowers the victim. Deciding that you have no choice but to leave because your partner is so horrible is denying the fact that there are always choices. Our experience is that relationship troubles are almost always two-sided. If you can acknowledge your own contribution to the problem, you can work toward solving it. If your relationship problems include anybody being physically violent or emotionally or verbally abusive, it's not time to waffle over whose fault it is. It's time to get professional help in learning to resolve conflict in a non-destructive manner. There are definitely agencies, clinics, and support groups in your area that help both battered and battering partners. Similarly, professional support is often a good idea to deal with substance abuse. No partner, no matter how wonderful, can resolve something like alcoholism with love alone. If a child is being abused in any way, safety becomes the first priority and you need to leave right now. You can work on resolving these issues from a safe distance. Breaking up It happens. Good relationship skills and high ethics don't mean you get to be with the same partner or partners forever and ever. It is our experience that relationships change. People grow out of them. People change. They may acquire new desires, new dreams. Some breakups in our own lives, as we look back with 2020 hindsight, were actually constructive moves toward personal growth and a healthier life for each of us. At the time, however, we just felt awful. It helps to remember that in the contemporary world, a breakup doesn't have to mean that you and your ex did something dreadful. Most of us can count on going through a breakup at some time in our lives, possibly quite a few times. Rather than hide in denial or torture ourselves with wondering what we did wrong, what would happen if we thought in advance about how we would like breaking up to be in our lives? When a traditional marriage breaks up, nobody takes that as evidence that monogamy doesn't work. So why do people feel compelled to take a sluts breakup as evidence that free love is impossible? Your breakup may be for reasons entirely unrelated to the openness of your relationship. At any rate, it probably isn't evidence that you aren't meant to be a slut. We suspect you wouldn't have done all the hard work it takes to live this way if you hadn't had a strong desire for sluthood in the first place. When a relationship shifts dramatically, it's great if everybody feels calm enough to separate with affection and equanimity. But all too often, partnerships break up in a harsh way, with painful, angry, hurt, and bitter feelings. Grief at losing a relationship that we had counted on cuts deep. And while we are going through the hurtful process of an unwelcome separation, none of us are at our best. A typical grief process takes about 3 months to get past the acute phase. It helps to look at grieving as productive work. Loss has left a hole in your life, and you need to pore over what you valued as you figure out how you want to fill the empty space and knit the wound together. You probably will need to do this work on your own. Your ex can't really do it for you. Feelings of grief, loss, abandonment, anger, resentment, and such that are overwhelming or intolerable today will probably seem sad but manageable 3 months from now as you move through this process. As the most intense feelings die down, you can find a good time to get back into communication with your ex. Have some coffee or go to a movie or some such. It would be a shame not to come out of this breakup with at least a friendship after all you've shared. Breakup etiquette in the 21st century. Sadly, many people approach the ending of a relationship as if they have been given a license for drama. And furthermore, some people just can't leave in a good way. They need someone to blame, other than themselves, a villain, a perpetrator, the bad guy, to feel okay about themselves or to clear their consciences. The internet has provided us with fabulous new technology for accomplishing drama. Friending and unfriending, publishing your wise and wicked judgments about your recently beloved, spreading your indignation like lava over everything. So while surfing the web has brought new opportunities, tons of information, and a great many joys into the lives of contemporary sluts, it also offers unprecedented opportunities for acting out, especially during the sensitive period surrounding a breakup. All the rules that tell us who it's safe to confide in go triple when electronic communication is involved. If you're in the habit of using your blog or social networking page as your personal journal, please consider keeping a separate page. If it's online, lock it so you're the only one who can see it, but we actually prefer paper for this, on which you can pour out anger, blaming, grief, and all the other emotions that are important to feel, but inappropriate to share with your entire online community. As for junior high school behavior like making a big drama about unfriending someone on your MySpace page, well, just don't. If it's no longer appropriate for an individual to have access to your personal information, consider posting less personal information for a while, or, if you absolutely must, simply remove that person from your friends list without comment to them or anyone else. Unfriending someone so you can badmouth them behind their back is silly and rude, and they'll probably hear about it from some mutual friend anyway. Look for safer and more constructive ways to vent your feelings. If you look at advice columns from the early 20th century, there is considerable judgment about the rudeness of using a typewriter, horrors, to write a personal letter. New technologies often seem very impersonal at first, and email is no exception. The advantages and disadvantages of email are the same thing. On a computer screen, you can't use your face or body to communicate, and little smiley and frowny faces don't really help much. Email can be very helpful in clarifying a point that feels too emotional or dangerous to communicate with your voice. But it can also come off sounding a lot harsher than you meant it, since your sympathetic smile gets lost somewhere in the ether. Who gets the friends? One of the joyous consequences of open sexual lifestyles is that everybody tends to get interconnected in an extended family, sexual circle, or tribe. When a couple breaks up with lots of pain, then the whole circle is affected. For the people in pain, it can feel like there is no privacy. Your friends and other lovers may be full of their own ideas about who's in the wrong. It hurts them when they feel your pain, so the entire circle may start looking for someone to blame. Ethically speaking, the separating couple has some responsibility toward their intimate circle, and the circle has some responsibility toward the erstwhile couple. The members of the couple should refrain from trying to split the community. In other words, you don't demand that all your friends sever whatever friendships they may have with your ex. And you don't divide your community up into those who are on your side and those who are against you by virtue of who continues to speak to your unspeakable ex. Privacy is a touchy issue here, because no one likes the consequences of gossip run amok. But we all need a confidant to tell our troubles to, especially in hard times. Sometimes separating couples can make agreements about who it's okay to talk about private matters with, and who we would rather not have familiarized with our dirty linen. Other times, no agreement is reached, and the chips fall where they may. If you feel that you and your ex should not be at the same parties for a while, you need to work that out with each other, and not wind up screaming at your host for having invited both of you to the same event. It is particularly unethical to call up the host of a certain party and demand that your ex be disinvited, or to threaten not to come if your ex is invited. This adds up to foisting your work off on your friends. It is your task to set your boundaries, to make agreements with your ex, and if you find yourself feeling bad in any place where your ex is also socializing, then it is your decision whether to stay or leave. If you wind up deciding that you want to attend this event so much that you will just have to deal with your ex's presence, good for you. You will get some practice at sharing social space with your ex, which you are going to need to do eventually, unless one of you moves to Timbuktu. Eventually, with practice, you will get good at dealing with your feelings about your ex, and all of this will hurt less, and you will be closer to achieving resolution and even possibly friendship after a bitter breakup. Your circle of friends and family is responsible for not getting split, for listening without judging, and for understanding that all of us think harsh thoughts while we are breaking up. Validate how bad your friend feels, and take any condemnations with a grain of salt. The exception to this rule occurs when a breakup is based on the revelation of serious issues like domestic violence or destructive substance abuse. There are no easy answers here, because a circle of sexual partners really does need to make judgments about these things. But most of the time, the accusations are about what a thoughtless, selfish, insensitive, needy, bitchy, dishonest, manipulative, passive-aggressive, rude, and stupid oaf that ex-partner is. We have all been all of these at some time or another, so we should be able to understand and forgive. Happy endings are possible. While breakups are very hard for all concerned, and while we understand that you may feel very angry, sad, abandoned, or ill-treated for a while. We implore you to remember that your soon-to-be ex-partner is still the same terrific person you used to love, and to burn no bridges. Janet says,
after our divorce, Finn was very angry with me and pretty depressed, and I felt very guilty. Still, for the sake of the kids, of whom we had joint custody, we made a point of staying on civil terms. Now, 20 years later, I count him among my best friends and wound up being one of his support people during his serious illness a couple of years back. If we'd been awful to one another back when things were raw and difficult, I don't think we'd be able to be on such good terms today, and we'd both have missed out on a very important and rewarding friendship.
Smart sluts know, even if they sometimes forget in the heat of conflict, that a breakup need not mean the end of a relationship. It may be, instead, a shift to a different kind of relationship, possibly a relationship between courteous acquaintances or friends, or maybe even lovers. Dossie relates, I dated Bill for 2 years, during which our connection on all levels was wonderful to me, especially an intense sexual connection. We explored a whole lot of famous firsts together. So we moved in together, and that lasted for all of 6 months before we blew up in a massive fight and separated. We really did have very different life goals. It was about a year before we could be around each other much, but then we started dating again, and the sex was even hotter and more profound than before. We wound up getting together once a month or so for the following 9 years, as good friends and lovers, continuing the lovely, steamy sex that had brought us together in the first place.
Exercise, a healthy breakup. Make up a story about a healthy, constructive breakup. Include details about how each person could work through difficult feelings. Invent agreements for right after the breakup, for 6 weeks later, for 6 months later.
One of the nice things about being an ethical slut is that your relationships don't have to be either or. You may have as many ways of relating to your friends and lovers as you have friends and lovers. Once you have survived a breakup, there's not a lot worse that can go down. A relationship with an ex is real security. A friendship with someone who has seen you at your utter worst. When we know someone with their complete complement of flaws and failings, as we do our exes, we have the foundation of a truly intimate and important relationship that can continue to change, grow, and provide support for many years to come. As Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote, after all, my erstwhile dear, my no longer cherished, need we say it wasn't love just because it perished? Chapter 21, Sex and Pleasure. Sex is nice and pleasure is good for you. We've said this before, and it bears repeating. In our present lives, your authors enjoy sex for its own sake, and it feels natural and comfortable. But we want you to know that it wasn't always this easy for us. In a culture that teaches that sex is sleazy, nasty, dirty, and dangerous, a path to a free sexuality can be hard to find and fraught with perils while you walk it. If you choose to walk this path, we congratulate you and offer you support, encouragement, and, most of all, information. Start with the knowledge that we, and just about everybody else who enjoys sex without strictures, learned how to be this way in spite of the society we grew up in. And that means you can learn, too. What is sex, anyway? The word sex gets used as though everyone agrees on what it means. But if you ask people what they actually do when they have sex, you'll hear about a huge range of behaviors and interactions. We have talked before about sex being part of everything and about everything being part of sex. Now let's talk about the parts that most people call sex, the parts that involve lips and nipples and clits and cocks and orgasms. Sex may involve these parts, but we don't think it's about them. The genitals and other erogenous zones are the how, not the what. The what sex actually is a journey into an extraordinary state of consciousness, where we tune out everything extraneous to our emotions and our senses in this very moment, travel into a realm of delicious sensation, and soak in the deep connection that we share in sex. This journey is a voyage of awakening, as if the nerves whose job it is to transmit feelings of delight had been lying asleep, but have suddenly leaped to attention, aflame, in response to a nibble or a caress. Perhaps what we call foreplay is a way of seeing just how awake we can get, all excited attention from our earlobes and ankles out to the ends of our hair, the prickling of the scalp, the tingling in the arch of the foot. The glorious miracle of sexual anatomy is that any of these awakenings can set off the swelling in the loins, lips, nipples, cocks, and cunts, which awakens lots more intense nervous networks buried inside us till we are all lit up like fireworks. Sex is anything you can do or think or imagine that sets the train in motion. A scene in a movie, a person on the street you think is hot, swelling buds of wildflowers bursting in a meadow, a fragrance that opens your nose, the warm sun on the back of your head. Then, if you want to pursue these gorgeously sexy feelings, you can increase the swelling tension and your sensual focus with any kind of thinking or touching or talking that humans can devise. Stroking, kissing, biting, pinching, licking, vibrating, not to mention erotic art and dance and hot music and silky stuff next to our skin. So sex covers a much larger territory than genital stimulation leading to orgasm. Sex that's limited to perfunctory foreplay and then a race down the express track to orgasm is an insult to the human capacity for pleasure. Here's a happy way to answer the question of what is sex. If you or your partner is wondering whether you're having sex at any given moment, you probably are. We like to use an expanded definition of sex, including more than genitals, more than intercourse, more than penetration, and, while we definitely would not leave them out, much more than the stimulations that lead to orgasm. We like to think that all sensual stimulation is sexual, from a shared emotion to a shared orgasm. One friend of ours, a professional sex worker, remembers,
"I'd had a regular session with this guy once before, but one day he showed up, put $400 on the table, and said that he just wanted to talk. So we lay down together on the futon and talked all evening. It was one of the most intensely sexual experiences of my life. It felt like being in love. We were in this profound heart chakra communication, a space of pure communion that felt luscious and sweet, as thick as honey. We were close enough that we could feel the heat of each other's bodies, almost but not quite touching. We tried touching a couple of times, and it diminished the energy. We were so turned on, I felt nauseous. It was mind-boggling."
When we expand our concept of what sex is and let that be whatever pleases us today, we free ourselves from the tyranny of his hydraulics, the chore of getting her off, perhaps even birth control and barriers, if we decide that outer course is perfectly good sex in and of itself. Pleasure is good for you. So do what pleases you, and don't let anybody else tell you what you ought to like, and you can't go wrong. Bringing clean love to sex. Remember the clean love in the moment and without expectations that we talked about earlier in this book? It's a skill you can bring to your sex life, and it's based on getting present and accepting yourself. Cast your mind back to your childhood, sometime you remember being happy. Children are naturally adept at being in the moment. To recover that consciousness, take yourself to a park and investigate that interesting twig you found in the interesting dirt. Go to a beach and take your shoes off. Wade at the water's edge. How do your toes feel? in the grass, the sand, the surf. Dig a hole in the sand while the tide is coming in. Pay attention to your surroundings. Pay attention to your experience. Then pay that same rapt, joyous attention to your beloved. This will probably feel good. So do it some more. You are a nice person. So is your beloved. You both deserve to feel good. Hands-on skin is a great way to get into the present, into connection, and into love. Wash each other's feet. Find some lotion and massage your lover's feet. Take turns. Put aside future tripping. Will this lead to sex? Who cares? The two of you are in the moment, feeling your feet. Your authors are in no way opposed to the intense beauty of genital sex. But all of us need to work on paying attention to what we feel in the moment and to how that connects us to the people we love. We are not in the moment while we are planning the future. Too much wonderful sensual joy gets lost in projecting what will happen next. Learn to enjoy mystery, that little frisson up the spine when you realize that you're on a path to something interesting. Follow that path and find out where it meanders. Appreciate the miracle. Don't miss the glories of the moment in your zeal to zoom up to the crotch like a superhighway, fast as ever you can. Efficiency is not what we're looking for here and now. The feet are relaxing. You hear a groan of ecstasy. Should you slide your hand up that gorgeous leg? Oops, let go of that and get back to those tender, sensitive feet. Nobody can relax and feel their feet if they're worried about what you are going to do next. When you bring your full attention to making those feet feel better than they have ever felt before, you're in the moment, and so is your partner, lost in the bliss of a tingling, creamy instep. And when you are through, reconnect in a lovely hug or a sweet cuddle, and then figure out what you two would like to do next. Whatever that may be, vow to stay present with that too. Perfect presence and acceptance is an ideal, perhaps never to be perfectly achieved, but transcendent even in the trying. It's a joyous practice of letting go of what's not needed right now, washing away all the grit and dust of your histories and expectations, and opening yourself as completely as possible to meeting another person in the fullness of your open, waiting heart. What obstacles do you face? Good sex seems as though it ought to be easy, but often in our experience it is not. Everything from ignorance to distraction can get in the way of responsible, enjoyable sex. Here's our A-list of fun spoilers. Sex-negative cultural messages. At the top of the list, many of us start out paralyzed by shame and embarrassment, even after we figure out that we don't want to be embarrassed by sex. Shame, and the beliefs we were taught that our bodies, our desires, and sex are dirty and wrong, make it very hard to develop healthy sexual self-esteem. Many of us spend our adolescences consumed with guilt for our sexual desires, our fantasies, and our masturbation, long before we managed to pull anything off with another human. When we did connect with others, many of us spent those encounters obsessing about our performance, often so busy worrying if we were doing it wrong that we forgot to notice how good it felt. When our desires and fantasies stretch further than a monogamous marriage with a member of the opposite sex, we suffer additional attacks on our self-acceptance. To some, we are sex-crazed perverts, deserving objects of scorn to others and all too often ourselves. According to some people, even God hates us. It's hard to feel good about an expansive sexuality when you feel so bad about yourself that you just want to hide. Body image. None of us look sexy enough. The advertising and fashion industries see fit to line their coffers by making us all feel bad about our bodies so that we will buy more clothes, makeup, cosmetic surgery, or whatever, in a desperate attempt to feel okay about how we look to others. The perfume industry floods us with images designed to convince us that we smell bad. And if we smell worse than these highly synthesized scents, we must smell very bad indeed. Even those lucky souls who are young and thin and cute suffer from constant worry about how they look. Why else do you think they throng to gyms and aerobic classes? The more people you want to share sex with, the more people you are going to have to expose your naked body to, so there you are. To enjoy a free sexuality, you need to come to terms with the body you are living in. Unless you want to wait till you lose 20 pounds, which could take forever, or until you look younger, don't hold your breath. Do remember, your sexiness is about how you feel, not how you look.
Exercise. Buy something sexy. Go to a store, any store. A discount clothing store, a thrift store, a lingerie store, a sex toy store. And buy yourself something sexy. Something that feels sexy to your body today. Sensual is a good place to start. Anything from silk to soft new flannel or really fine cotton. Loose fitting or tight. It doesn't matter what it looks like as long as you feel good in it. What colors are sexy to you? Rich, deep shades? Delicate hues? What expresses your inner slut? Close your eyes and feel your way through the racks. Leather and velvet are divine to the touch. So invite the touch you dream of. Even sun denims are startlingly sensual. So try buying your jeans by feel. Let go of what anything is supposed to be and let your skin choose what it wants. Go home and parade around in it.
Age and disability. It is foolish and rude to assume that people with physical disabilities don't enjoy sex. Differently abled people may indeed engage in differently organized forms of sexuality, but that doesn't mean no sex at all. People with spinal cord injuries who have lost all sensation below the neck report orgasms. There is a lesson here for all of us about how sensitive our ears and lips can actually get. Sex for a person with physical disabilities is not that different from any other form of sex. Focus on what you can do, what you can feel, what feels good, and how to go about experiencing the most intense feelings that this particular body can feel. Learn about your body just as any other person does. What supports you in moving or reaching? How can you deal with any medical appliances? What safety precautions must you keep in mind? Most important of all, what do you like? People who have lost physical abilities in accidents may spend a long time rediscovering what this new body can do and feel. Finding what feels good is the joyful part of the journey. People disabled from birth or childhood often get treated as non-sexual beings. They may need to go to work when they grow up to discover what their sexuality can be. Don't forget the advantages of using tools. Vibrators tap into the entire electrical grid for their strength and endurance and never get repetitive stress injuries. Implements can reach where arms may not, and pillows can prop up any limbs that need propping. Medications, hormones that keep vaginas flexible and moist, pills that help sustain erections, can help with some of the sexual changes that relate to aging or health issues. Investigate possibilities. Whether disabilities are visible or invisible, like asthma or diabetes, you get to explore what works for you and get cooperation from your partners to work around anything your body can't do. If the prospect of being a lover to a physically challenged person seems utterly strange to you, don't forget that one day you will be old. At what age do you plan to give up enjoying sex? Will you just give up at the first obstacle, the first bit of arthritis that interrupts a nice thrash with a painful twinge? We do hope this book supports you in grasping your sexuality in any way that works for you. Remember, whatever the physical possibilities of the body you or your friend inhabits, the most important sexual organ is always found between the ears. Sex disinformation. Another obstacle on our course is inaccurate or just plain bad information we may have learned about sex. For many years, information about sexual behavior and basic functioning was censored, along with most other discussions of sexual pleasure. Depending on where you live in the culture now, you may or may not have access to good information. We need to politicize to protect our right to accurate and positive information about sex. To acquire a basic knowledge of sexual functioning and how the sexual response cycle works in men and women, we recommend strongly that you read one or several good books. Books about sex provide a lot of information, more than we can give you in a chapter, about how sex works and what you can do about it when it isn't working as well as you'd like. Self-help exercises are usually provided for concerns about erections or orgasms, timing, coming too soon or too slowly, and what to do when you can't find your turn-on. You can learn more strategies for safer sex and birth control, and more language so you could more easily talk with your partners about all of this good stuff. Some clever sluts read a chapter a week of a good book with a partner, and perhaps talk about it on Friday over dinner, a nice way to prepare for the weekend. These days there is also a lot of information and discussion on the Internet. We applaud this freedom of information, and we also want you to be careful, because much of the information you read and hear about sex will be inaccurate. Because sexology is such a new science, and because research into what people actually do in sex is difficult and often inconclusive, and because we as a culture have not talked explicitly about sex for a very long time, fairy tales abound, and reality can be hard to come by. Collect all the information you can, use what works for you, and take it all with a grain of salt. Fortunately, there's lots of sex information available these days in books, magazines, podcasts, websites, and more, plenty to choose from. The best part of learning about sex is that you'll love the homework. Speechlessness. If you can't talk about sex, how can you think about it? The historical censorship of discussion about sex has left us with another disability. The act of talking about sex, of putting words to what we do in bed, has become difficult and embarrassing. Although most of us have had the experience of failed sexual functioning in one way or another, most of us never get the chance to get support from our friends and lovers about it. Sexual dysfunction becomes our secret shame, a position from which it is virtually impossible to figure out a way to function better. What little language we can use to talk about sex is riddled with negative judgments. Either you speak in medical language of vulvas and penile intromission, which sounds like you need to be a doctor to talk about sex, so it must be a disease, or you have gutter language like fucking cunt, hard dick, that makes everything sound like an insult. What you can't talk about, you can hardly think about. A crippling disability. People who can't use words often resort to trying to communicate without words, pressing their partner's head downward, moving their hips, trying to get that tongue in just the right place, feigning ecstasy when a hand strays in vaguely the right direction, while hoping desperately that the bewildered partner will figure out what they're trying to ask for. Wouldn't it be easier if we could just say, "I would really love it if you ran your finger around my clit in a circle instead of up and down." Or, "I need you to grab my dick much harder." Goal orientation. The tyranny of hydraulics is a tremendous obstacle to terrific sex, and not in the way that the manufacturers of Viagra would have you believe. Many people believe that if there is no penis with an erection, nothing sexy is happening. Lesbians, of course, disagree most vehemently. Many men feel they can't even engage in foreplay while they are soft, and many women are insulted if they discover a soft penis while they are getting aroused. And still more people are completely nonplussed if the penis in question decides to release at a time that is inconvenient for the rest of the activity, as if there were no sex after ejaculation. We want to encourage you to think beyond the hydraulics of erection and allow your playful explorations to go wherever they want to go, no matter where the participants may be in the sexual response cycle. When sex becomes goal-oriented, we may race to orgasm with such single-minded focus that we never even notice all the lovely sensations that come before and, for that matter, after. When we concentrate our attention on genital sex to the exclusion of the rest of our bodies, we are excluding most of ourselves from the transaction. When we ignore most of the good parts, we increase our chance of developing sexual dysfunction, and we miss out on all the good feelings. Gender roles. To be truly free to explore our sexual potential to the fullest, most of us need to examine how we have been taught that a man or a woman is supposed to enjoy sex. Many of us were taught that it is natural for men to be sexually aggressive and for women to be passive responders. Your authors like both of these roles and many others too. When it comes to what feels good, we are all highly individual human beings, and despite what you may have heard, we all come from the same planet. When men are forbidden to be receptive, then a man is not allowed foreplay or to ask for any sensory input at all. He's not supposed to need it, much less want it. So then if a man is not automatically turned on when his partner is, he may wind up thinking he's impotent when all he needs is a little nibbling on the ears. Women consigned to passivity can fall into the sleeping beauty trap. Someday my prince will come and so will I. Because people in fairy tales always have simultaneous orgasms, right? In the real world, however, a woman who is allowed to take her turn at being the active partner is well on the way toward figuring out for herself and her lover what works for her to get really, really hot. Active and receptive are both great roles when they're not dependent on gender. Think of oral sex. Is 69 the only way to enjoy it? Or is there a particular delight in taking turns? When we focus on the active role, we can all be great lovers and get off on our partner's pleasure. When it's our turn to receive, we can truly appreciate the gift we are being given, not to mention feeling free to thrash and shriek and otherwise express our appreciation. We'd love to see a world where everybody knew how much lovely sex they have to give in the active role and how much they give their partner when they receive. How can we learn good sex? The mythology has it that once you start having sex, it will all come naturally. And if it doesn't, then you must have some deep-seated psychological problem, right? We're not sure why sex stands alone in this regard. If you want to get good at anything else, from cooking to tennis to astrophysics, you're going to have to put some effort and time into learning how. If you want to enjoy sex and to make sure your partners enjoy it too, you're going to have to do the same thing. One friend of ours had her first orgasm at the age of 34, after reading for the first time in one of the sex manuals that became popular in the early 70s, that it was okay for her to masturbate. She'd grown up in the generation that was told that masturbation would make you sick or crazy. This is a horrible story. How many years of orgasms did this woman miss because of bad information? Whatever you do now, you learned somewhere, somehow, so you can learn new or different sexual skills and habits if you choose. Learning requires some effort, but the rewards are great, and we know you will be brave and persistent. Many of the books we recommend include exercises you can use to expand your sexual skills and your repertoire. Try them. Talk dirty. Talk to people about sex. Ask them about their experience and share yours. Janet remembers seeing her first porno movies and feeling confounded because the women in them all masturbated face up, and she wasn't sure if she'd been doing it wrong all those years. She started asking her women friends and found that she was far from alone, not only in her face-down preference, but also in her sense of uncertainty. Talk to your intimates and any friends or people you respect who are accessible to you. Breaking the ice can be scary at first, but establishing discussion about sex with your friends and lovers will be a valuable resource for all of you. Well worth risking a few minutes of embarrassment as you get started. A friend of ours used to believe that she was the only person in the whole world whose cheeks got sore from sucking a big cock. Talking to a few friends let her know that she was in the majority. If you find you can't talk intimately and explicitly about sex with your lovers, then how can you deal with a problem or try something new? Good sex starts with you. We mean this quite literally. When Masters and Johnson began their research into sexual functioning in the late 1950s, they wanted to start by learning about good sex before researching sexual dysfunction. So they started by selecting 382 men and 312 women, including 276 heterosexual couples, all of whom had satisfactory sex lives. One surprising fact they uncovered was that virtually all these sexually satisfied people masturbated, regardless of whether or not they were also having partnered sex. Write this on your mirror. Sexually successful people masturbate. You are not jerking or buzzing off because you are a loser, because you can't find anyone to play with you, or because you are desperate to get your rocks off. You're making love to yourself because you deserve pleasure, and playing with yourself makes you feel good.
Exercise. A hot date with yourself. Set aside a couple of hours for this. Turn off the telephone, lock the front door, and get rid of any distractions. Then prepare as though you were preparing for a date with someone you were very excited about. Put clean, soft sheets on the bed and place all your favorite sex toys near to hand. Next, take a steamy bubble bath with candles or a luxurious shower and close shave, accompanied by soft, sexy music. Style your hair, perfume yourself, trim your nails, rub in lotion so your skin is soft and touchable all over. Slip into silk boxers or a sexy nightie. Have a glass of wine if you like. When you're ready, turn the lights down flatteringly low and lie down. Tease yourself with soft, gentle touch all over, feeling your soft hands as though they were the touch of your perfect lover. Take your time. Tantalize yourself with lots of foreplay, using your hands, maybe your mouth, and maybe a toy or two. Only when you absolutely can't stand it anymore, when you would be begging for release if there were anyone there to beg, may you bring yourself to climax as many times as you like. Lie there and soak up the warm, rich feeling of loving yourself enough to give yourself slow, mindful pleasure. Your perfect lover is waiting for you anytime you want, right there in your own skin.
We have never met a person who suffers from low self-esteem at the moment of orgasm. Your relationship with yourself is what you bring to a relationship with another person. It is what you have to share, personally, emotionally, and sexually. The sexier you are to yourself, the sexier you will be to your lovers. People who play with themselves are good lovers for two reasons. First is that sex with yourself is a really good time to explore new sources of stimulation, like touching yourself in different places, or vibrators, or new positions. Because you will never fail to notice what doesn't feel good, you will always do it the way that feels best, and there will be no one to get embarrassed in front of. So masturbation offers you an opportunity to practice all sorts of interesting things. For instance, if one of your goals is to be able to enjoy more sex before you come, you can practice relaxation exercises with yourself and learn to slow down and speed up your response however you like. If your concern is that sometimes you are not able to come when you would like to, you can pay attention to what works for you when you have sex with yourself and teach your partner your particular preferences in sexual stimulation. Try different rhythms and stimulations so that you don't get into a rut of being able to get off on only one sensation. Practice makes perfect, so masturbate a lot. Start by putting some energy into supporting your own self-esteem and developing a positive feeling about your body. No, not the body you plan to have next year after you work out every day and live on lettuce. What have you done recently that helps you feel good about the body you are inhabiting today? It's hard to have a good relationship with your body when all you do is yell at it. Try giving your body treats. A bubble bath, a trip to the hot tubs, a massage, silk underwear, anything that feels good. be nice to your body, and then go find somebody else's body to be nice to, and somebody will be nice to your body, too. Love yourself as you would your lover. Masturbation is a good way to nourish and develop our relationships with ourselves.